Hi everyone, and welcome back for another edition of One on One. On today's episode, we're going to my stomping ground, the world game, football. Specifically, the artists of the spoken word, those painting the pictures of what is happening on the pitch. Today, my guest is none other than Bundesliga World Feed commentator Dan O'Hagan. Dan has over 25 years of experience broadcasting some of the biggest encounters in football, including the Revier Derby and Der Klassiker, just to name a few. I spoke with Dan about the challenges of commentating during the pandemic, his love of football, and so much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Dan, thanks so much for taking the time to come and speak to us. How are you today?
Yeah, pretty good. Here we are now, the last week of the Bundesliga season, so all kind of beginning to kind of gear up for that summer mode. But yeah, it's been a strange year, a strange season, but it's been great fun.
It has been. And of course, Bayern, once again, getting the wood. Dortmund finishing the season quite well. But it is still all to play for at the bottom of the table. I'll get a quick prediction from you. Who do you think goes down along with Schalke, and who's in the playoff?
I mean, having seen Schalke's last couple of games, there's a bit of fight there now, so it's not going to be an easy game for Köln at the weekend. And I just really fear for Bremen. I know they've changed the coach. Thomas Schaaf has come back in this, you know, firefighting role, but the run of form they're in, that's hard to break. So right now, you know, you look at Bielefeld's last game as well, tough one away at Stuttgart. It's really hard to call. I mean, I literally wouldn't like to make a prediction, because you can make a case at the weekend for, you know, all those teams getting results or all those teams losing. So it may be we stay as we are, or there may be some movement, but it's been a really interesting relegation fight. You look at Köln, we've seen them go away and win at Dortmund. We've seen them beat Leipzig at home. On their day, they can do it. But I just feel with Köln, their chance was missed when they didn't change the coach for so long. Gisdol was in position for far, far too long. And I think every other team changed at least once their coach up until that point. And I just feel Köln were maybe too complacent. They maybe felt they had a better team than they had and stuck by Marcus Gisdol for far too long. And they are where they are. I've really enjoyed Bielefeld. I think they've really gone about it in a very aggressive fashion. They know what they are. That is, in essence, a second division team punching way above its weight. I did the game at the weekend when they drew at home with Hoffenheim. I've done a lot of their games this season, and there's real fight there. And every game for them is like it's a cliche, but like a cup tie. And you can kind of feel in Bielefeld that fight, that desire. And I think if they were to get across the line, they would have deserved to stay up. Bremen, though, I think they're the ones who, you know, this has been coming for several seasons. Last season, obviously, the near miss of the playoff. This season, it may be the playoff again. And I know the club's got enormous financial problems, but you look at that squad on paper, and that should not be a team third bottom with one game to play in the Bundesliga. And I just feel with them, as I say, I think their form is such that of the three teams, they're the ones for me who are most in danger.
I actually tend to agree with you. They have shades of Hamburg for me from many years ago before they were eventually relegated, where they kind of got a lucky result here and it kept them up and eventually it was going to catch up with them. And it's going to be fascinating. I think that's one thing is for certain. If Bielefeld do stay up, a statue of Stefan Ortega is a must. I don't care what anyone says, but he's been unbelievable. I think he was stiff to not be in the Euro squad. And that save on the weekend, which he called brilliantly, that was spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually done two great saves. There was one against Leverkusen back in March, which was almost superhuman. But that save at the weekend against Hoffenheim was probably the best save I've ever called live. It was that good, because I think I said in commentary, he was going the wrong way. He had no right to save that. You know, he kind of sticks out the arm and flicks it over the bar from Kramaric. And he's been great. I agree that I think for the Euros, he should have been at least the number three goalkeeper for that squad named by Yogi Löw this week. He deserved it. Performance is magnificent. And I'm sure he'll get a move to a very big club, maybe as a number two. But certainly, I think of Bielefeld's players this season, he has been superb. And I just think, that save of the weekend underlined what a great campaign Stefan Ortega's had.
100%. I know my friend who I do the Zweite Bundesliga podcast with, Eva, won't mind me saying this, but she'll be praying that he doesn't leave to go to a particular club in Bavaria, especially, that might be looking for a number two. But yeah, he's been fantastic. Enough about the Bundesliga. I want to talk about yourself. So I guess the first question I have to ask you is, where did your love of football come from? Because sometimes it comes spontaneously, family influence. Where did it start for you?
It was quite late in me. I mean, I don't think I played football till I was maybe 8 or 9 years old. And I first came across football at my nan's house. She had an old kind of silver transistor radio. And one afternoon I was kind of fiddling with the dial. And I came across a game on the radio. It was Derby County. And it was the year they got promoted back to the First Division, which I think would have been 86 or 87. And I was hooked. You know, the kind of the crowd, the kind of crackly commentary on the medium wave radio. And yeah, I mean, that was, you know, my kind of Damascene moment. That was football for me, discovered and kind of fell in love with the game. Then began playing at school, got into school teams and all that. And yeah, I think for me, the first World Cup I watched was 1990. Watched every single game that I could. Ran home from school for the early kickoffs and yeah, loved it. So yeah, here I am now, 43 years old, and been working in this business now for 25 years almost. And yeah, it's a wonderful sport to be involved in.
It is. That is one thing, and there's a great community of people who cover the game. They provide information. I know there's we'll talk about a little bit later how information like statistics and expected goals and stuff like that can go into the commentary, but. So you start at a young age. I'm curious, where did commentary come into the mix for you? Because like everyone kind of, I know this was something I did as a kid. We'd be playing at school. The two classes for the year level would play, and there would be someone who would be yelling and screaming out the play-by-play, which happened to be me. So where did it start for you?
It was that love of radio, I think. Yeah, I mean, we didn't have Sky TV as kids, so we got all our football through the radio, really. So with me on the BBC, voices like Peter Jones and Brian Butler, later Mike Ingham, Alan Green. And I just kind of fell in love with the idea of football commentary. My ambition was always to go into radio commentary. That was my first love. But the first job I got was at MUTV in Manchester, so I kind of fell into TV commentary, which is unusual because normally, certainly my generation, the route into TV commentary was always through local radio and then national radio. But with me, I kind of got into TV, so I was quite different in that regard, that I got into it straight away and through TV. But yeah, I mean, commentary, you know, I listen back now to my early stuff and it's embarrassing, you know. So you do kind of develop a certain style and a certain gravitas the older you get. I listen back to now my early games on Match of the Day in the kind of, you know, mid-2000s, and it's nowhere near what I am today. I mean, my voice sounds completely different. And I kind of wish that maybe it'd come along a little later. I did that show for 11 years. I don't think I ever kind of did myself justice. But having done the Bundesliga now for 6 years on the world feed, doing one or two live games every weekend, you know, it's made me develop as a commentator so much. And yeah, I think right now I'm enjoying my work, and I think producing work as good as I've ever produced before. So it just kind of shows that with commentary, you mature. You know, it's like a player. You know, you chuck a young kid in there for their debut and they're quite raw, but by the time they hit kind of 29, 30 and they're seasoned professionals, that's when they're at their best. So yeah, I love what I do. It's the best possible way to earn a living other than playing the game. It's the kind of second best thing to playing. So yeah, absolutely love what I do.
It's fascinating. You mentioned how your voice has matured, much like a fine wine. These things get better as age goes along. But you also mentioned style. If someone was to ask you on the street who watched your commentary, how would you describe to someone your style of commentary?
I think it's, you can look at maybe newspapers, tabloid and broadsheet. I try and be a little more broadsheet in that I'm more considered. You know, I don't tend to shout and scream too much. My voice doesn't really kind of lend itself to shouting and screaming the way some commentators do, which is great. I mean, the fact there are so many different styles is wonderful, but I tend to be a little more kind of considered, a little more I try not to use too many words. I think when I was younger, I would try and describe every pass, which is radio commentary. And I remember I was at the World Cup in 2014, and we're talking to our producers, and he said, "Dan, I'm a huge fan of yours, but you talk too much." So we did a game. It was Spain's last game against Australia. I just tried for that game talking less. And it was, again, like a kind of Damascene moment that, wow, here we are, you know, you've got more time to think. You've got more time to produce that killer line. You've got more time to tell a story. I think my style certainly has developed and it's much more considered now. It's much more, as I say, broadsheet. And, you know, that's maybe not to everyone's taste, but I think certainly you look at the Bundesliga pool of commentators and there's a whole range of different styles in there. I think we all have our place. I think my style, it's different and it's evolved. I mean, I listen back to, there's a Twitter account and they post up old videos of Norwich games. I spent 5 years working for Anglia TV in the East where Norwich were the big team on our patch. So I listened to my commentaries from kind of 2002, 2003. And you can barely recognize it's me because I used to talk faster and the voice was more high pitched. And again, I'd talk too much. So, you do develop over time. And I'm sure even now, you know, 5 years on, I'll sound different again. But we do develop as commentators for sure.
How important is that for a commentator to really not only just develop the craft as a whole, but to really bring something new to the table? You look at, I guess we can take the Bundesliga pool of commentators. You've got the likes of Derek Ray, who is internationally renowned, commentates on the FIFA games, is doing the Olympics for NBC, Euros for ESPN. You've got Kevin Hatchard, who is very well-respected. Phil Bonney, of course, as well. Do you also compare yourself to those guys and say, oh, I like what he does, maybe I might kind of bring that and incorporate it into my work as well?
I think, yeah, I think, you know, certainly Derek especially, because Derek is so highly thought of among us, but also in the wider industry as well. So I was saying this on the other day that you can't listen to a Derek Ray commentary and not learn from it, either in terms of what he's saying or how he says it. And that's incredible. So, you know, we've had Derek with us now for, I think, 5 years. And, certainly, I think Derek's had a kind of real influence on all of us in that we've all kind of raised our game because he's at such a level and we want to kind of be on that level or as close as we can get to it. It's great. And the pool we have in the Bundesliga, all different styles, but all really good mates. And that's, I think, what makes it for me working on the Bundesliga is that camaraderie and team spirit, which I've never had before, because you're so focused on one league. And obviously now we think things like WhatsApp groups as well, which wouldn't have had 10 years ago. So there's much more interaction between match days, between the commentators. So there's a real kind of team ethic and a team spirit there. And I think we kind of push each other now. So, you know, we kind of, without even saying, kind of set our standards that you kind of don't want to let your teammates down. And that for me is something very new that I'd never had before in the business, that you're part of a team and you kind of push each other week in, week out to kind of maintain or improve on the levels of the week before.
And that's interesting because commentary as a whole seems very individualistic. I've lost the will to speak already and we're only 13 minutes in. It seems very individualized, like everyone has their own style. So that's fascinating that the Bundesliga core commentary group, there's a couple, I think, like James Thorogood, Rob Turner and Rob Daly and all these other guys. So it's clear that, you know, not only has everyone got a style, but it's good that you guys are like a unit. I think that's fascinating. So I guess I'll take you back. Do you recall the first game you commentated?
Yes, on TV it was a reserve team game for MUTV, Man United versus Barnsley. Reserves played at Bury's Gig Lane, co-commentary with, I think, Lou Macari. And I think it was probably a 2-2 draw maybe or 2-1 to United. And that would have been maybe October, November of 1999, my first TV commentary. And at the time I was very happy with it. My bosses were too, and you know, I got more games, so it kind of been awful. But I'm sure if I listen back now, I wouldn't recognize my voice or my style. because the thing with commentary is there's no commentary school as such. No one teaches you how to do it. So just to give you an example, you go on air now, and because you know the first maybe 10 minutes of the show, they're going to be you'll see a live table, the team lineups, teams out. Now the commentators will script that, which I didn't know. So I never used to script my introductions until maybe 10 years later, because I didn't know that's what you did. So you'd kind of go on air and literally just wing it, which obviously leads to all kinds of mix-ups, and you stumble over your words and you kind of lose your train of thought. So no one teaches you the basics of commentary. So it's all very much self-taught. You learn on the job, you learn by your mistakes. So yeah, I listened back to those early games, and you wouldn't recognize the style at all, the voice at all. And it's just that those mechanics of commentary, you know, now you look at a game, as I say, you go on air, you'll have your intro that you've scripted. You know, you're going to see a shot of the referee, so you have a line on the referee. You know, you're going to see the team lineups, which you'll script as well. And then you're into the game. So then you start the game and you'll have a killer line at kickoff. You'll bring in your co-com and away you go. But that takes a time to learn. That's what's going to happen. So you don't... I'm sure there are some guys or female commentators now who've gone into the business and straight away have nailed it. But not many have. It's a very difficult game to kind of nail out of the box, to kind of get those little things right straight off. And no one ever has a perfect commentary. You'll have a good one, you'll have a middling one, you'll have a bad one, but no one ever has a perfect 90 minutes. And that's, you've got to accept that. You can't, you know, we all make mistakes during games. You can't let those mistakes kind of really get into your mind. Just kind of say, okay, I've said that was wrong or not well phrased. We'll just crack on now and the game continues. But yeah, it's, you know, you listen back to my earlier games, like that first one for MUTV, and you would not know it was me.
It's interesting, and this is kind of where preparation comes into the forefront. Something that I see, especially a lot of Bundesliga commentators, including yourself, do, is showcase your match sheet, the match preparation sheet of every player who's going to be in. How important is that match preparation to get the reason? Here he is on screen, which you can't see on the podcast, but I will post something on when I actually release the episode. So can you explain to me the process you go through to develop the match sheet for yourself?
Yeah, well, the match sheet here, this is for the weekend's game, Dortmund against Leverkusen. And what I do is the first thing I do will be to write, I've got grids printed out, so I will write down by hand, side by side, the two squads, every player who may reasonably be expected to be involved in some way in the match, even injured players, because you want to know when you look back at those notes why he didn't play, why was that player injured. So you go through that, and that will take about a day to write, again by hand, every single player's pen picture. So things like, is this game a landmark? Is it his 50th match, 100th match? Is he on the verge of a personal best for goals this season? Has he ever scored a hat-trick? So all that goes down along with the season stats. So goals, assists, cards, appearances. And that will take a day, as I say, for the two squads. Then you do a second sheet, which is the kind of games, facts and figures. So what's the club's head-to-head like? What's their season been like? What's their current form like? Are they a good home team? Are they a good away team? Again, are there any major records or landmarks looming up that this game can see them break or equal? And I think, again, with the Bundesliga, because it's a very stats-driven league and a very stats-driven world feed, we always have to make sure that we're on top of all this. We do get from the German people, they do send us a pre-printed stat pack, which is often quite basic. So we all do our own prep anyway, to make sure nothing's missed out. My biggest fear in a commentary is for something to happen that I'm not prepared for. Doesn't matter how small it is. You know, for example, we had at the weekend Leipzig. I did Leipzig-Wolfsburg, and they had on the bench, I think, Leipzig, a lad who was 16 years old and 29 days. And I had to find out before I went on air, if he would have been the club's youngest goal scorer and where he would have been in terms of the Bundesliga's records in terms of youngest scorer, youngest appearance as well. Because you don't want those major milestones. As you know, for example, we've had in the last few years, Yusuf Moukoko, Florian Wirtz breaking records, Lewandowski almost by the game breaking records for Bayern, Erling Haaland as well. We had a couple of years ago, Claudio Pizarro becoming the oldest scorer of all time in the Bundesliga. You don't want to miss these things. And we take great pride in making sure that we have every single base covered as best we can before each match. So, yeah, I think, you know, for a normal Bundesliga game, per game, I would say I put in probably 2 days of prep per game. So on a weekend where I've got two matches, that's 4 days of prep before we even start to broadcast. So it's a lot of work. I mean, there are ways of cutting corners, and sometimes I'll have a week during the season. For example, in the autumn, when you have Bundesliga going on, you've got Champions League, Europa League. I was doing last season the Chinese Super League as well. So you could have a week where you've got 6 or 7 games and you just cannot physically find the time to do that level of prep. But you don't like to go in at all underprepared. So I never go into a game underprepared, but sometimes have more prep than I would for other games because I've simply had more time that week to do my research.
That's fascinating. You've commentated a bunch of different leagues, the Premier League, Bundesliga, Chinese Super League. I guess this is a really difficult question to answer. Can you describe how different those leagues are to cover, considering you do the Bundesliga on the weekly, and then I do remember that you were pitching in to do Chinese Super League a bit of last year, and how different is that in terms of maybe your preparation? Does it change anything, or, you know, what's different in regards?
I think Chinese Super League was difficult because they were teams that you rarely saw. And also the language as well. Chinese names were very difficult because the pronunciations are not as written down. And for someone who takes great pride in getting things right, that took a lot of research. But the Chinese stuff I did was immensely satisfying because to do a good job on that league, you had to put the legwork in. And, you know, I really enjoyed that last season. Sadly, this year, the rights have gone to a different company. So at the moment, I've not been able to kind of do any Chinese games this year. That may well change, but we shall see. But yeah, I mean, the Chinese league was a great. I did that for 5 years, I think, on and off. Last season, because of the format, I did a lot more games than in previous years. But yeah, I think most European leagues, the format in terms of the TV production is pretty similar. I know Bundesliga and Premier League are quite similar. I used to do the French World Feed 10 or 15 years ago as well, before that moved to a different company. So I think European leagues, you know what you're going to get. With the Chinese league sometimes, and also the TV production wasn't quite as it might have been for your European company as well. So you'd kind of get, you know, really weird timings where ad breaks would appear when they weren't supposed to, and the graphics would be maybe appearing at the wrong time. So you had to be kind of on your toes for that a bit. But I found the Chinese league, when I worked on it, extremely satisfying because it was such a hard league to do right, to do well and do right.
Interesting. Is there a league that you haven't covered yet that you'd be really intrigued to do?
I've done in the past Italian football, Serie A, and I loved it, but I've never done it for long. It's always been the odd game here and there. So I'd love to get involved in that more. Spanish football I find really good. I love what La Liga TV are doing in that they now have gone over the top and that they have produced their own channel. So rather than sell the rights for a league, they now almost sell the league direct to the viewer. So in the UK here, on Amazon, I subscribe to La Liga TV, so I get that channel with all their live games. And I think that's a really intriguing way of doing things now, because you're going to see, I think, TV, the money and that bubble might burst, you know, and league rights become less attractive to broadcasters. So the league, I think, now will more and more be selling directly to the viewers, like the Spanish are doing, and, you know, who knows, maybe the Premier League might do in the future, maybe even the Bundesliga might do in the future, is produce that almost in-house channel and sell that as one, you know, via Amazon or via Netflix or whatever streaming platform it is. And I think that is a very, very interesting development to keep an eye on for the future, not just for football, but other sports as well, maybe.
I think that would be fascinating for the Bundesliga. I know that we were talking about this off-air, about the desire to get the Zweite Bundesliga a little bit more attention. As we've seen this year, we've got a title fight. Three teams can go for promotion on the final match day. Hamburg missing out for the third year in a row, which a lot of people find hilarious, but you know that they are the breaks. It would be an interesting thing to have where you can, you know, have all every game Bundesliga, Zweite Bundesliga, doesn't have to be particularly commentated on, although it would be great, and just sell it as a package, monthly subscription. I think that would be pretty good. That's just me personally. I'm not sure how you would feel about that, but I think that would be a pretty good, it's a good start at least.
I mean, I think for us guys, if there's more work out there, we'll take it. you know, so I think certainly in Germany, the second Bundesliga has never been more attractive. Next season, obviously Schalke, maybe Köln, maybe Werder Bremen, maybe Hamburg as well. So big clubs in a second tier is always going to be attractive. I know I do a lot of work for the English second tier world feed, the EFL. And I know the people who do that were saying that when they had teams in that division like Leeds and Aston Villa and Wolves, their viewing figures for their takers were through the roof because these were big clubs with a huge global following. So I think you're seeing right now in the German second tier a really unique time where you've got so many big and storied clubs playing in that league. It's literally a second Bundesliga, in that the size of the clubs in some cases is enormous. So in terms of a world feed, I'd love to see it one day. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but I'd love to see in the future, and not just the German second tier too, but I think all us football fans, we have an interest in football and stories, and you want to see where, you know, clubs have come from. So when you get a team like in England, Leicester City, you know, for years and years, they were playing in the second and even the third tier. And now obviously Premier League champions 2015-16, now the FA Cup winners as well. You want to see where those clubs have come from. And I think, you know, to be able to dip in to the second division, La Liga TV, for example, they show a second tier highlight show, which is great. So it just shows there is a market out there for second division football. But I think, you know, every commentator you'll speak to, because the more games there are, the more work we get, would always be in favour of it.
Absolutely. Can't argue with that logic. Obviously, we've been dealing with the pandemic. COVID has, especially for a lot of English commentators who live in the UK, travelling to Germany is a bit difficult. Can you explain how you've had to adjust to not actually being at the stadium or heading to Köln at the DFL office, soundproof booth area? How different has that been, considering it's not maybe ideal considering the situation?
Well, the fact I'm using the gear to talk to you right now is stuff I've bought to work from home. So, you know, last March when the league went into suspension for a few months, we kind of had a big long think about how to do things. It became pretty obvious that travel was going to be off the agenda for a long time. So we went out and we all bought equipment to be able to, in theory, work from home in some way. We never thought that live games from home would be possible because of the time delay and the expense and the need for mega broadband. It just seemed pie in the sky. But to the DFL's immense credit, we've managed it. Now, we finished last season doing games from studios in the UK. We used the AP studios in Camden in North London. And that was great. But obviously that was an expense to kind of pay for those facilities. So what the DFL did wonderfully, they were very front foot and they found a way of doing it from home. So they went to a company in Spain called Prodis who specialized in streaming broadcasting. And we have got these boxes now which enable us to connect to our home broadband and get the pictures coming in. Our audio goes out. It all goes into Cologne where it's all synced up. So my voice will match the pictures to the exact split second. And you wouldn't know the difference. We now even have co-commentators. So, for example, Sunday's game, Leipzig against Wolfsburg. I was in my living room here, or my girlfriend's living room more accurately, because my home broadband's not fast enough. So I was sat here and I had a little laptop monitor with Stefan Freund on a Zoom call or a Microsoft Teams call so I could see him, he could see me, and it was as good as being sat next to him. You know, you can gesture, you can kind of, you know, get him to come into commentary, make eye contact, and it was brilliant. So the fact we can now do that, and I don't think I've seen anyone on social media say that sounds definitely like they're not there or they're in two different countries, which I think is testimony to just how good this has been and how the DFL have absolutely nailed the idea of home commentary, which now has become second nature. You know, it does seem weird that I can come downstairs, plug in my equipment and be commentating live, you know, in theory from Leipzig or from Dortmund or Bayern, whatever. And it just sounds like it would do were I in Germany. So I think with travel and these days, obviously, the idea of a global footprint, I think home commentary is probably going to be here to stay in some capacity now for forever, because we've shown that it works. The equipment can only get better with time. Yeah, I think we've kind of almost been trailblazers this season and almost kind of guinea pigs learning on the job. And, you know, it has been at times in the early days, there were problems with internet crashing or whatever. But I think by and large, it's been pretty much trouble free. And we've shown it works. The technology works. And yeah, I think, as I say, it's here, you know, I think for the long term.
It's interesting. One thing I can definitely say from watching the Bundesliga this season, it's definitely not noticeable, which is ideal. I mean, for example, I was watching Schalke and Hoffenheim, a game that you called, which Matthew Hoppe scored a hat-trick, and it was amazing. It was about 1 a.m. here in Australia. Two mates who were desperate to see Schalke get the record brought them over. And they left very, very disappointed. But what was very clear is that the commentary was crisp. You couldn't tell that you were doing it from your living room. And obviously Schalke won, which was a massive positive for me because I haven't seen much of that this season. So you did mention the co-coms coming in. So you get Stefan Freunde, Sean Dundee, and there's a bunch of other really good co-coms. What are the signs that you use to interact with them? You did talk about how maybe giving them the eyes or kind of gesturing. Was that something that you would do just to say, hey, like without actually saying it, I want you to come in. This is a really important point.
I think most guys now I've worked with so often, they kind of know almost second nature when they come in. By and large, to a new co-com, I'll say, right, first of all, you take the replays. They're your domain. So basically, when a goal is scored, I'll kind of talk away, blah, 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 scores, fourth goal of the season, give a kind of killer line. Then we get the slow-mos in which the co-com will come in and, you know, wax lyrical about the... a co-com, I think, their job is to say why it's happened. I say what's happening and they say why. So they'll come in and explain why that goal has been scored. And yeah, and in general play for a rookie, I will ask them direct questions to get them, you know, familiar and comfortable with being on air. Because don't forget, again, there's no kind of school for co-commentators. So they're kind of thrown into it. I remember our first ever co-com that I did was with the Moritz Volz. We did the Revere Derby, Dortmund Schalke back in 2016, I think. That was done from Cologne back then, not on site. And it was Moritz Volz's first ever attempt at co-commentary. It was very, very flat, very, very low. But Moritz is a very bright guy and he took it on board. And by the next game, he was bang up there at a very high level. So it's a tough skill, but the guys we use in the Bundesliga, we make a point, I think, of only using guys who've played in the Bundesliga at some point. So we've got a very knowledgeable pool of co-coms, and again, you know, they've kind of improved game by game and they're now all at a really high level, I think, in terms of analysis and personality and being able to add to the game. So yeah, I think the co-coms we use are very, very good. In terms of how I bring them in, yeah, there'll be gestures like, you know, I'll kind of thumbs up or kind of to make them be quicker. If like maybe an attack is building up, I'll kind of do a wind-up sign to kind of say, oh, okay, finish your point. I'm going to come back in here. So yeah, you've got that contact. And I do think that you do need a video link if you're not there in person so you can see them face-to-face because, you know, you don't want to be talking over someone because that does sound awful. Even for a couple of seconds. So we all have our kind of signs and our nuances and almost our kind of vocal tics to bring someone in. And the co-coms kind of know now, because they've worked with us for 3 or 4, 5, 6 years, they know how we all work as well.
Interesting. You've also done commentary by yourself. Is there something that you change in your approach to commentary when you commentate by yourself, considering that there isn't that person who has the... I guess, real world football playing experience. Is that something you have to try and incorporate differently, or do you just kind of keep it natural as you are?
I think on your own, you try and be maybe a bit more tactically aware, because obviously you haven't got the COCOM to kind of bring in that aspect in terms of, you know, identifying systems and particular traits. And also now we have in the Bundesliga our on-screen graphics, so our match facts, where, you know, for example, doing an Eintracht Frankfurt game, you can say that, you know, you can see that they're using the left-hand side a lot with Kostic coming down the left-hand side, crossing into André Silva. We have graphics now that can back that up. So we can see the attacking zones from each team across a match, and that can really help as well. So I think on your own, yeah, you do try and be a bit more kind of tactically descriptive than you would be with a COCOM, but there's not too much change these days.
It's interesting because one thing that I have seen a lot, especially with the Bundesliga's partnership with AWS, as I've got, as you'll see now, on so that the incorporation of expected goals, attacking zones, has that, do you reckon that's enhanced your ability to commentate the game as well as the overall broadcast package?
I think it has, yeah. I think whatever can help to tell the story, I think you can use. And I think at first it was quite hard to bring these into commentary, but now we found a way, and we use it, as I say, to kind of enhance the way we tell the story. For example, we have a match fact now, which is speed alert. So it tracks each player's top speed during a game. And I did the game Frankfurt-Mainz 2 Sundays ago. And in that game, Gerrison just broke the season speed record. And I said in commentary at that time that, you know, he's one of the quickest players in the league. I think at that point he was maybe the third fastest player in the Bundesliga. And then my voice in Cologne said to me, that's a new season record. We can put the graphic in now. So straight away we had a graphic to underline what I was saying and seeing, and that worked really well. So those graphics, those little touches we have now just enhance, I think, the product and enable us to tell the story in a more informed and graphically interesting way. I'm sure other leagues will go a similar way as well, because, you know, things like expected goals, that works too, because again, it tells a story. There was, I think I saw a graphic on the Bundesliga's social media today saying Lewandowski's expected goals for the season were 26, and he's got 40, so he's way ahead of his expected goals. And again, that tells a story. So yeah, the little things which on their own maybe don't sound like much, but as part of the wider picture, when you put it in with your normal commentary and your normal knack of telling a story in a football game's context, they really do help to, I think, enhance things for everyone.
I would agree. I'm going to change tack here and talk about games that you've commentated on. Is there one game in your entire career, spanning over 25 years of pure brilliance, is there one game that stands out to you as maybe not the best game in terms of commentary, but the best game in general, like the overall spectacle?
There are probably two. I think one's obvious. It was the 2017 Leipzig 4 Bayern 5 game, which was just absolutely incredible. Leipzig's first home game against Bayern. At one point, though, I think Leipzig were 4-1 up. Bayern came back to 4-4. Then Arjen Robben with a typical Arjen Robben goal wins it in the last minute. That was amazing. But for me, one that sticks in my mind is a game probably no one even saw or remembers. It was the Under-17 World Cup in Nigeria back in 2009. I was on site in Kano in Nigeria. It was an amazing, warm, kind of almost tropical night. And it was Spain against the USA. And that Spain team had players in it like Sergio Roberto and Isco. Borja Bastón was up front, who played at Swansea in the Premier League briefly. And it was such a good game of football. The way that Spanish team played was incredible. They won the game 2-1. They had a man sent off, I think, in the first couple of minutes, and still won 2-1. It was just brilliant. Pablo Sarabia scored the winner, a fantastic volley, playing now, of course, at PSG. And it was just one of those occasions where you saw these players kind of being born onto the world stage, only 16, 17 years old. And as I say, Isco, Sarabia, Sergio Roberto in that team. And you kind of knew this was special. And to be there and see it in the context of the game, a full house in Nigeria, atmosphere incredible. That was special. As I say, a game people may not have seen or will remember, other than those who were there or playing in it. But I think to be a part of that and to see that was something really special.
I think it's underrated, those U17, 19, 21, even 23 championships, and especially seeing players that in the future will grow and maybe become some of the world's best. I think one that comes to my mind was the U21, the Julian Polisbeck penalty shootout, where he saved three or four penalties and Germany made it to the final, which they ended up losing to Spain in the final. I can't remember, but that's when he came onto the scene. He had that okay season at Kaiserslautern and then joined Hamburg, and everyone was on top of him. Like, okay, he can do this now. And he's now at Lyon, if I'm not mistaken. I think he's at Olympic Lyon after being completely dethroned in Hamburg. I guess that leads me on to the Euros, which is only less than a month away, actually. Any predictions on who do you think might win? There is one group in particular that is stacked with teams, Group F, which has, I think, France, Portugal, and Germany, and Hungary, who probably wish they had an easier group. Do you have a prediction on who might take the trophy this year?
I don't know. I think it's very hard to call international football. I do think England have their best chance in a long time. I think that young squad they have now, we've seen Phil Foden's form in the last couple of months. There's a player peaking at the right time. Jadon Sancho, those who watch the Bundesliga will know what a season he's had again for Dortmund. If Jude Bellingham goes, incredible as well. Only 17, but plays like a man of 25, 26. I think England have a very good chance. But I look at the Germany squad named by Jogi Löw this week, and there's quality there. Yeah. And obviously a team who want to make amends for the World Cup. They want to maybe send Jogi Löw out on a real high. I think the recalls of Hummels and Thomas Müller, I think, are very, very significant too. I mean, that's a coach admitting to his mistakes and wanting a fresh start. And I think that's a good place to open a tournament with, a kind of clean slate. So you look at Germany, as you say, they're a tough group. France, you can never look beyond France. You know, I was thinking at the weekend, I did Leipzig's game against Wolfsburg, and you look at the young defenders France don't even use. You know, Maxence Lacroix, Ibrahima Konate can't even get near their squad. So, you know, France have just so many good players. They'll be very strong as well. You know, I look at Italy, you know, after so many lean years, suddenly one or two signs that they could be a force again as well. So it's going to be a wide open Euros. You know, England, I think, as I say, in a good place with good young players. But I wouldn't like to make a prediction and say who'll win the thing. But let's hope for a good month of football.
Preach. Absolutely preach. I'm going to back France, by the way. So someone will definitely take that out of context. And when they get eliminated in the group stage, it's going to come back to bite me. But, you know, I'm going to go early. I think it's going to be a fascinating tournament. I think the Euros brings a lot to the table. Hopefully, if it's safe enough to have people in the stadium. I guess that's another question I can ask you, is how different has it been to commentate games without fans? I mean, I can imagine it's a bit eerie, no?
I mean, because I've done so many youth tournaments like the Under 20 World Cup and the 17s, where sometimes you don't get many fans, you're kind of used to it almost. But, you know, when you're calling big moments in the Bundesliga, you want a crowd there. I just thought Lewandowski's 40th goal at the weekend. Mm. Great occasion, great achievement. But imagine that with a full house. And that's a shame. Obviously, it's been done for the right reasons. The DFL's protocols have worked superbly well. To have got us, you know, a season and a half in these times has been incredible. And I just think, though, for the viewer, certainly with the Premier League, I found very sterile this season. I've not watched much Premier League because I've just found the games very artificial, less so than Germany. I think the German games have felt more real in this time. And also with our world feed, we don't get the fake effect. So we just hear the stadium noise, and it can be quite hard to kind of raise yourself to, you know, call a moment when there's no kind of response there from the fans in the stadium. So I can't wait to get back to, you know, fans as near as we can get to full houses as soon as possible. And when it's safe to do so, because football, we've seen, haven't we, in the last 12 months, 15 months, the fans are so much of football. Without them, it really isn't the same.
I can tell you, in Australia, and this is where I'm very lucky, we're very lucky here, that our major sporting codes, AFL, NRL, the A-League, have got to a point where they can have 100% capacity. There are obviously things they have to do, QR code into the stadium, mask on until you get to your seat. When you move around the stadium, you have to have the mask on at all times. It's something they do here in Adelaide, and they do very well, and they're getting to a point where they can have 40 to 50,000 people. And it's so noticeable where teams, home teams especially, they feed off the energy of the crowd, and they also cop it when they don't play particularly well, which we've seen on many occasions. So that's something that, you know, especially people in Europe will can't wait to see. I mean, there was when Dresden got promoted last week, they had, I think, there was like 10,000 people waiting outside the stadium. Maybe not the best move, but I know something that Union are doing. They're going to have 2,000, I think they're having 2,000 at home this week, I believe. Kiel aren't doing anything in their game, which they have, they win, they get promoted. So I will say this, that it's going to be, when it happens, it's going to be amazing, because I know that football's been starved of it, and it's something that, yeah, football is nothing without the fans, and I think the last 18 months have definitely shown that. One final question, and I did ask this, so you've had plenty of time to think about it, but I already know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If you could change one thing in football, what would it be and why?
It's obvious. I think VAR needs changing. I think the idea is really good. I think the idea of correcting big and blatant and game-changing mistakes is a good one, but the execution's all wrong. I think in the Bundesliga, we get it pretty much right most weeks, but England apply it so, so poorly, it almost beggars belief. I think with things like goal line technology, it's black and white. The ball's either in or out. But I think with the penalty calls, it becomes, again, down to the referee's interpretation. So you still have that human error involved in the process. And I just think that needs to be looked at. We need a standard to be imposed in terms of how handball is penalised. Because at the moment, I mean, my team are Wolves, and last night we played Everton, and I thought there was a stonewall penalty for a handball for us, which wasn't given, which in other games would have been. So it's that lack of consistency, I think, which drives us absolutely mad. I think most leagues have struggled. The Bundesliga has been pretty good with it. I think the Premier League, they just haven't managed to get it right. And it's been embarrassing. You look at the Premier League, I think most match days, there's at least one, if not more, big controversies. In Germany, it's maybe two or three a season. And that tells a story. My fear is that in England, it's a case of the referees think they know best. So you've got this almost schoolmasterly cabal of referees, the PGMOL, and it's almost like they don't want the thing to work. So it's this awful interpretation of all manner of things, which leaves us with a situation where every weekend there's a major controversy, which does no one, it doesn't do the Premier League any good, doesn't do the referees any good, doesn't do VAR any good. So I think we need a big rethink over how it's applied. As I say, I think certainly there's a place for it. I think when it works well. But it's that consistency which just isn't there. Until that is in place and it works properly, and people know what they're getting from VAR, I think it, you know, almost shelve it until it's at a workable state, because right now it's not.
100% agree. Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I wish you all the best for the final game of the year, and I look forward to hearing you again for the next season of the Bundesliga.
Real pleasure. Thank you. Enjoyed that.
Dan articulates the game in such a brilliant way, and that certainly came across when I spoke to him. His passion for what he does is such a delight, and how interesting was it to find out the camaraderie between himself and his fellow Bundesliga World Feed commentators. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was an absolute pleasure. We can't wait to hear you back on the airwaves when the Bundesliga returns in August. I'll be back with the next episode of One-on-One shortly. Until then, subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you are listening to. You can also follow me on my socials, which are in the description. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.